enlightens me, and my spirit feels free. Oh, what a dawn. Hey, brother, just believe it. Hey, sister, you are standing there in it, in a brand new day. Troubles, put your hand in mine. Walk with me into a brand new day. It's a brand new day. God's love will be your reward. But come on out with me, 'cause you know he set you free. So praise the Lord. Yeah, praise the Lord. Hey, people, just believe it. Child, children, you are standing there in it, in a brand new day. Your troubles, put your hand in mine. Walk with me into a brand new day. It's a brand new day.
Hello. Welcome to Living Free Show. My name's Bill, and you're on 3CR Community Radio, 855 kilohertz on your AM dial. This week, we're talking about recovering from alcoholism and how support from a 12-step group like Alcoholics Anonymous can make a real difference. I'd like to welcome Chrissy.
Hi.
And Michael.
Hi.
Into the studio this afternoon. They're members of Alcoholics Anonymous and will share their experience with alcoholism and how AA has helped them. Chrissy, you're daughter of an alcoholic as well as an alcoholic.
Yes.
So do you want to tell us a bit about how that all started for you?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Bill. Okay, so I'm Chrissy. I'm an alcoholic and I'm really grateful to be sober today. It all started for me, you're right, my father is a functioning alcoholic, so are my sort of aunties and a lot of the members, that side of my family basically, are alcoholic. Lots of people have, you know, grandfathers, grandmothers died from alcohol-related illnesses, and it's addiction in general is pretty rife on that side. But mum and dad split up when I was younger, so I wasn't actually raised by dad, but yeah, genetics were definitely there, and I was raised by my mother, who, you know, that side of the family have a whole other set of problems, mental illness and goodness knows what else. But you know, she really tried, and she was a single mum with my sister and I. And I guess in desperation, she did her best, but it sort of made for a really unstable upbringing, and you know, did a lot of moving around, and she always desperately tried to find the right person and what have you, and that meant a lot of kind of, yeah, moving into different people's houses and becoming attached to people, and then, you know, detached, and yeah, so by the time, for example, I met my husband in my early 20s, I'd lived in about 45 different houses, so
right. Yep.
You know, there was nothing was, yeah,
no stability,
that's yeah. Right. Yeah. In saying that, mum really did try, but you know, I feel that my sister and I both are, you know, things that happened in our childhood certainly contributed to being a very unhappy, you know, child, and always lacked self-esteem and felt very apologetic for living, you know, very sort of, yeah, constantly saying sorry, extremely shy, just really quiet, and just wondered how on earth I was going to do this thing they call living. You know, I just from an early age remember thinking, it's just so hard, I can't do it. And why can't I be, you know, like all of my friends or the other kids that I see of my age? Why can't I didn't know then, but be happy, joyous and free. I just couldn't, you know, and yeah, it just felt quite young to already have those thoughts, and it felt overwhelming to look forward in my life thinking this is going to be a long haul, you know. Yeah. So yeah.
So how did you start? What led you drinking? How'd you start?
Okay. I started basically age 14, went to a party. It was a family member's party, so we didn't have too many people watching over us. Like, my cousin was older and yeah, they were all drinking. I drank Bundy rum. It was in Queensland and that's what they drank. And, yeah, and I knew sort of not to mix it with Coke, or I really wanted that effect. I didn't want to have it watered down. I knew that it was going to give me something that, that I'd like or that I needed. And I wanted the full effect quickly. And that's what I did. I literally sculled it down straight and, had a water glass, like a chaser, just to, you know, cool down that burn. But, I really felt the wonderful effects of alcohol, immediately. And, from that day forward, it became just what was at the forefront of my mind, basically. That was, well, they say king alcohol. It was everything. I wanted to go to parties. I sort of survived or existed between drinks, and everything was about, I mean, I used to sort of wag school and I'd be under bridges with homeless people. I'd think that, you know, I was being very sort of worldly and what have you, but I was 14 and 15 years old, you know, and I'd hang out, yeah, with all the kids that were sort of wards of the state. So I guess I'm not really, it wasn't the wrong sort of kids. I'm sure they were lovely people, but I, actually went to private girls' schools. Like, that's, you know, my dad paid maintenance and I went to all these sort of really, really nice schools. So I guess I was, my parents certainly expected more of me, and I was, you know, as I said, just cutting school and hanging out with people that hadn't been to school in years and they were 16, you know. So, and just, I guess, I saw it as being rebellious and being a bit cool, and, you know, in retrospect, obviously it wasn't, but I'd had that taste of alcohol and what it could do for me. And for me, it allowed me to feel normal, or it allowed me to feel as good as the next person. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I didn't like drinking to excess in that, you know, I didn't like drinking till I dropped, because I hate the dropping part, but I loved the drinking part, you know, and I could never... because kind of gauge. Couldn't get, that's right. I always overshot the mark. You know, I really wanted to be three or four drinks in and stay that way. And it just, that's not my story.
No. So one of the things that always interests me is that alcoholics on their first drink, it just makes them feel terrific. Like it solves all their problems.
Yeah.
And they usually can't stop on the first drink. Was that your experience?
It certainly was, yeah. I mean, I didn't know at the time what I know today about alcoholism, and that I have, you know, an abnormal response to alcohol, or an allergy, an allergic reaction. And, you know, I completely identify with that now. And looking back to that very first drink, you know, I can see throughout the history of my drinking that took place every time I drank. You know, I really had that... phenomenon of craving that kicks in that I cannot control. And you know, I can try and think my way out of that and try and, you know, intellectualize it and try and be smart enough to not let it take over, and that's what I thought I could do for a long time, and it doesn't work that way, you know. No. I have an abnormal response. It's physiological. There is nothing I can do about it. So
Yes, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Michael, how about you? You're a recovering alcoholic as well as the son of an alcoholic. So how did it all start for you?
Okay, yeah, so my father's he's a recovered alcoholic. He hasn't had a drink for 40 years. My mother's a heavy drinker and still is. And No, they separated when I was about four, and for me, in our household, I was the grown-up at the age of 8 or 9. My mother's really ill, and someone had to look after stuff, and I took that role in the house and looked after stuff. And I don't know, my experience is that that I learnt to lie at a really young age, and you know, I used to laugh. I used to go down the street to get smokes for my mum, and I couldn't come home without saying I'd been swooped by a bird or nearly hit by a car, or making something up to make my life sound a whole heap more interesting than it was, that I thought it was, and I knew it was wrong. And for me, I went to primary school out in the eastern suburbs and outer eastern suburbs, and I got a scholarship to go to school in St Kilda, and it was a long travel to go there, and it was the first time I dumped all my friends and started again, and then spent the rest of that time hoping those people never met the next group of people.
Yeah,
and juggling that the lies, the fact that I've made up all these lies with one bunch of people, and I've got a whole heap of other lies going with another bunch of people. I hope they never meet, and that was just, and for me, what happened was at the age of 13, I discovered alcohol, and I drank a bottle of port, and Orlando liqueur port, and it came in a really cool tube, and I am that kid who took a bottle of port to parties. You know, other kids drank West Coast Coolers and I drank port.
Yep.
And because I love the effect that happens to me when I put that in me. And West Coast Coolers didn't do it for me. And beer didn't do it for me. It was just too gaseous. It was too, you got to drink much too much of it to get the effect. And yeah, I could afford a bottle of port. You know, it was $8 or something.
Yeah.
I could steal that much. And that was alcohol. My first one, you just talked about that first feeling for drinking, and that's my experience. I put it in me, and that lasted for a long time. That first one went in me, and I go, like I've been, you know, breathing in for the last 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the second one goes in me, and this warm feeling comes over me, and the third one, the world changes. And
life's good.
Yeah. Oh, you bet. Everybody else is different. Everybody else is smarter, and they treat me better, and they're smiling at me nicely at the supermarket, and it's certainly teaching my kids better when I've had three drinks. And you know, if I could be three drinks drunk today, I'd be three drinks drunk right now.
Yeah.
But I can't be three drinks drunk. I've discovered that I can't stop at three.
Yeah.
And
yes, that's a real problem, isn't it?
that is the problem, actually. The only problem.
So Chrissy, you got out of difficult teenage years.
Mm-hmm.
So how did things progress?
I basically, you know, went to uni and, tried my best there, but basically, the only thing I remember from uni is that the uni bar was closed on a Monday night. Like, I remember that very clearly because I had to make alternative arrangements. And I was at Menzies College in La Trobe, Bundoora for a year. But, you know, yeah, to this day, I don't know where a lot of the lecture halls are. I went there, met new friends, as Michael's saying, and just partied. And look, a lot of us did, you know, that was the culture. And but I always tended to take it. I had the biggest consequences. It's always the way it been the way. Came home, and you know that, because the first year clearly didn't work out. And you know, I was a barmaid, and I barmaided for years.
Wow.
I loved it. Either side of the bar, it didn't bother me, because I drank either side. Yeah. Like it. I was down in Frankston and Seaford and Langwarrin and what have you, and all of the management in those hotels back in those days, you know, they'd be more than happy for me to have a few shots. And we'd kick on afterwards, like often 24 hours. I'd do a, you know, 8-10 hour shift, and then we'd party for 10 hours, and that was life. I met who was to be my husband, and he was the first person to sort of mention that my alcohol consumption or the way that I drank was different, you know, or he thought was different to other people. And I'd sort of known that for a long time, but I do remember him clearly being the first person to, instead of laugh it off, to sort of say, no, I think there is actually a problem here. And that was well before the real problem kicked in, you know, so... Yeah. It just never changed. It's progressive, this illness. It gets worse. And, you know, for me, that's exactly what happened. You know, I got married and we had children and we bought a house and I had a, you know, full-time job and a good career and all the things, the external things that I thought that I needed in life and that would change my drinking, my behaviour. And what I found was my drinking was getting worse and I just couldn't understand it. Like, you know, especially after having children, it made no sense to me because, you know, I knew that if I sort of had other human beings in my life that I loved enough that I'd live, you know, that I'd want to live for them. And that's just wasn't the case. It, you know, yeah.
Right. So, yes, it's when other people notice you're drinking, did that make you think about it?
Look, it did, but really I used to be quite open and vocal about the fact, because so many people had called me an alcoholic, initially I fought that and no. And then eventually I thought, well, actually, if I just ride with this and say that, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, maybe they'll shut up, yeah. You know? And that's exactly what I did. Like, so I sort of thought, okay, well, I'll concede and yeah, I am. And what are you going to do about it? That kind of thing. And as much as I had this horrendously low self-esteem, I also had these kind of delusions of grandeur where if my husband dared mention anything, I'd sort of think, well, you know, I'm so much better than you anyway. Like, how dare you? and like I said, yeah, what are you going to do about it? And I felt so uncomfortable myself that I wanted to make everybody else around me feel as uncomfortable so that, you know, I don't know, I guess that they felt...
It's called
felt,
transferring the guilt, isn't
oh,
it?
Is, yeah. Yeah, pretty much, that they felt privileged to be in my company, yeah. You know. And, I mean, what a horrendous sort of place to live in. And, so the drinking got worse. You know, I had three children. After the first child, I... the drinking basically got out of control again. I actually... became addicted to prescription drugs as well, OxyContin.
Goodness.
So we had a dual issue going on there for a while. I mean, I'll do anything to get out of my head, basically. And yep. Because I had one child at this stage, so I'd finally become a mother, I thought it was a lot more socially acceptable to be a prescription addict, pill addict, than you know. But eventually, yeah, the alcohol sort of snuck back in. And my husband said, you know what, you don't drink when you're pregnant, so why don't we try this again? We'll go for child number two. Stop drinking as you know did in pregnancy, and this time don't start it again. And we're like, yep, cool. And honestly, yeah. that was the whole plan. Yeah, yeah, that was the impetus for having another child. And then we found out we were having twins, and I remember looking up at the sky just thinking, well, wow. What are you doing? Like, and I thought to myself, you know, this will be the end of me. And I often say it was the end of my drinking. And, you know, so that's a beautiful thing.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Michael, so post-uni, what happened?
Oh, I did what other grown-ups do. I got married. Right. And I thought that would change me. And I met a woman who said that she liked me and that was enough. And I just held on for dear life. And actually, she would say that she saved me in the gutters of Fitzroy and of Brunswick Street and rescued me from those gutters, and she was going to change me, and so along the way, I went overseas. Actually, I went overseas and spent a lot of money of her redundancy from work and travelled with no responsibility, actually, no response, and drank my way overseas for 9 or 10 months, just drank and drugged my way through Europe. Didn't have to drive, didn't have to do anything, and it was a killer. Actually, really, yeah. Just knocked me about, and came back, and I was unemployable, and she got me a job, and we had children, and I thought that would change me because, yeah, people didn't tell me that I shouldn't drink so much. They just told me that the people who knew me just said you shouldn't drink. And
so it wasn't a matter of an amount.
No, it was never a matter of amount, because they'd never seen me drink and have a couple. No one I knew saw that happen. No, I don't remember it happening, because my experience, my thing, I have a friend who has a regular, every cup day he has an event, And if I go to that event and I've only taken one bottle with me, and I get there and they're thinking that maybe they're going to share two bottles between five, I just don't drink.
Yeah.
You know, rather than knowing that there's never going to be enough for me, I just would have none, and then I'm miserable.
Yeah.
And
extra miserable.
It's extra miserable. So I said I had children, and I just got old. I grew apart from my wife. She took on the responsibility. She changed from being my wife to being a parent, and she grew to have three children in the house, my two daughters and me. And
so were you drinking every day?
You bet. Yeah, I drank every day. I drove from my job in, you know, it was about a 45-minute drive home, maybe an hour, and that was about half a bottle of vodka. And my skill was being able to pour it into a travel mug that already had ice and cordial in it.
Wow.
And roll a cigarette and not spill a drop and not get pulled over and not kill anyone and not have all these things that could happen, you know, happen. But and then I'd get home and I'd come in the door and my children wouldn't know who was coming home.
No.
They didn't know whether what sort of man was going to come in the door, whether it was a guilty man who was going to shower them with gifts or a miserable man who was going to pick the hell out of everything they'd done and never been able to achieve anything that I'd, any standard that I would have set in my head before I got home. So they, there was no consistency for them. And my, you know, when I finished drinking, my kids were 11 and 8, my girls were 11 and 8, and they were scared of me. So.
Yeah. It's not a good way to be, is it?
No. I was 105 kilos and my skin were falling off me with psoriasis and, you know, I couldn't stop drinking. I just, and every night I would get in the car and I'd come home, I'd pull the car up in the driveway and my outside, my life looked really good. I had two cars in a garage and a big mortgage and a house in the burbs and a job that paid me a fair bit of money and a family didn't talk to me and no friends and I was lonely and miserable and I couldn't stop drinking.
Mm. Yes. It doesn't sound like a good way to live.
No. Yeah. Mm.
Okay, well, we're up to a song, a bit of nostalgia here. We have Crocodile Rock by Elton John.
Bye.
Okay, welcome back. That was a song called Crocodile Rock by Elton John. This is a Living Free show on 3CR, and we're 855 kilohertz on your AM dial or 3CR on your digital radio. As you may be aware, 3CR Radiothon was held on the 15th of June, and our show raised around $1,325. We've had two donations since last week that I'll read out. First one was from Gail, a gal who's local to the area around Fitzroy, $30. Thank you, Gail. It's fantastic. And the other one we had was from Ishita, $50. Thank you very much. I'll just play a sound applause. Ooh. What are we saying? What have I done? There we are. Back to the sheet. We hope that you value 3CR and Living Free, and you would be willing to provide financial support to keep 3CR on air. The Radiothon theme this year is Radio for Change, and that pretty much sums up Living Free. We're all about changing the lives of alcoholics, addicts and their families. Remember, your support will keep our message of hope on the airwaves, so donate generously. We're tracking pretty well in our current pledges for 3CRs, around $180,000, but we still need another $40,000 to reach our target. So here's a brief announcement to prompt you to help us out.
Want to support 3CR's diverse and independent voices? Well, it's not too late, and we still need your support. Donate now by calling 9419 8377. Or donate online at www.3cr.org.au or post us a cheque or money order to Post Office Box 1277, Collingwood 3066.
Now we're back. Now today we've got Chrissy and Michael with us from AA, and we're talking about recovering from alcoholism and how AA helps do that. Chrissy, what brought you to think that you needed to stop drinking, or you needed to do something about your drinking?
Right.
What was the trigger?
I think the real, I hear that the hope for sort of lots of alcoholics is that one day it's going to get better, you know, and that one day I'll get a handle on this. And, you know, I'd sort of achieved most of what I wanted to achieve and had most of the things I thought were important in life, and yet it was getting worse, as I was saying. So I had my twin boys and a little girl, and I was at home taking care of them, sort of basically a stay-at-home mum, and my drinking had become a daily sort of thing rather than just nightly, which was before having kids. The drinks had been sneaking into sort of early afternoon and lunchtime, and then eventually, because I was getting up for night feeds with the boys a few times a night, honestly, 24 hours rolled in to it was sort of day, night, whatever, and essentially I was drinking around the clock. And you know, even I knew that my drinking had progressed to a stage where even if I sort of wanted to let up, I couldn't. I was getting up for night feeds, and I'd put their bottles in the microwave, and I'd find that I had to sort of slam down a glass of champagne before a 40-minute feed because I was shaking and I felt really physically unwell. And because I'd had a bit of a nursing background, I knew that these were sort of the effects of alcoholism or alcohol abuse, for sure, and an addiction, basically. My liver was sore and my tongue was swollen, and I had pins and needles in my hands and feet, and I became really, really frightened. Suddenly, you know, I had these beautiful kids and a lovely husband and what have you, and for the first time ever I really knew that to drink might actually mean to die, you know. And
wow. Yeah.
So I had sort of this self-imposed ultimatum. I knew deep down that that it, to continue, yeah, drinking was really dangerous, and that I was going to have to look at getting some help. And really nothing else would, you know, I'd even consider stopping drinking for, aside from, I guess, the possibility of losing my life, you know, and that's what it came down to. So, I rang around a whole lot of rehabs one late one night or early one morning, not quite sure, just in the desperate hope that someone would help me, you know, for what I initially thought would be 7 days, just detox me for seven days, you know, and I'll go back to drinking normally, which, you know, and that's, you know, that's not exactly what happened. The first phone call was from a 28-day rehab, Malvern, and they were just amazing, and I lied, as Michael mentioned before, like, I'd become a really good liar over my lifetime, and told them I drank half as much as I did drink, and they said that I still really needed to be there. So, so I knew that, you know,
it was serious,
and you know, it was Christmas 2010, and I thought, once I finally got into the rehab, I said to the head doctor, look, you know, it's Christmas time. I've got 3 young kids. It's a really bad time of year to be, you know, in a place like this. Maybe I've made the wrong decision. Maybe I'll just, you know, come back next year. And he said, Chrissy, you won't see Christmas in July. And something I just knew he wasn't lying. I knew that was right, that I was really going to be running the gauntlet, and I wasn't prepared to lose my life. So I thought, I'm going to have to give this a crack, and did.
Yeah. So did you think you'd ever stop forever?
No. And actually, in that same meeting with the head doctor, I said, please, you can tell me anything you like. You know, fair enough, call me an alcoholic, call me anything you like, but just don't tell me that I have to stop drinking forever. And he said, I'll just tell you that you can never safely drink again. And I'm like, right. Okay. And then he said, but more than that, he said, look, just for today, you don't have to.
Yeah.
And, you know.
It's more palatable.
Yeah, exactly. And just for today, I thought, yeah, well, you know, maybe. Okay.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because I sort of said, well, how do you know I'm an alcoholic? And he said, well, first of all, I'm an alcoholic.
Wow.
And that blew my mind. Like, honestly, I couldn't reconcile that in my head, because I'd known, all I thought I knew about alcoholics was, you know, as you hear all the time, that they're the, you know, lay down, low bottom drunks that are in the gutters with the paper bag. Like, that's, you know, that is definitely what stopped me getting help for so long, because I couldn't understand that I wasn't at that level, and yet, you know, I still had this massive problem. But I'd never met, as far as I was concerned or knew, a recovering alcoholic ever. And
yeah.
I'd, as I said, came from a family where, you know, people die from alcoholism like yearly in my family, and yet no one had ever actually got sober and said, hey, there is a solution.
It's amazing,
so,
isn't it?
Yeah, really incredible. So I'm looking at this person who just looked quite normal and healthy and functioning, and he said that he was an alcoholic. And yeah, that really sparked my curiosity. I thought, well, there might be something in this. Let's see. Yeah.
Okay. Michael, what drove you to consider stopping?
Yeah, I guess I just couldn't stop, and I wanted to die, and I went to a doctor's, actually. I just went to a doctor's and I said I had a problem with drinking, and I was a little bit depressed, and he recommended I go and see a drug and alcohol counsellor, and I went, whoa, it's not that bad. And then I went and saw the drug and alcohol counsellor, and that she suggested that I go to a rehab, and I went, oh, really? And about a week, and I was on holidays from work, and you know, my head was, I've had just had 2 weeks off work, I'm about to go back to work, and then I'm going to go into rehab, I'll get sacked, da da da, and all these consequences that I'm thinking it out in advance. And what happened was, I got a phone call a week later, and I hadn't had a drink for probably 10 days at that stage, and I was back at work, and I got accepted into a rehab. And whilst I was at the rehab, you know, I got told about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was asked if I wanted to go to a meeting, and I was able to walk up to a meeting on a Tuesday night that was sort of 5 minutes up the road from the rehab, and it was dull and it was boring, and there was, you know, it was an old guy at the door who shook my hand and welcomed me in, and there were six people there, and it was a dingy dark hall, and two people were asleep in the back row on a couch, and people shared at the meeting, you know, they shared their experience of drinking and fighting and drinking and crashing cars and drinking and having the police involved, and I didn't have any of that. That wasn't my life at all. You know, if you weren't drinking in my car and you weren't drinking in my garage, you weren't drinking with me. There was just nothing social about my drinking. But someone got up and they at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and they talked about what they were like, what they felt like when they were sober, and they talked about how miserable and lonely, and how they couldn't sit with themselves, and the fact that they were having conversations with themselves in the car. And I really got that with the driving to work and talking to someone who wasn't sitting next to me in the front seat. And yeah. If they say this, then I'm going to say that. And then, and when someone shared that, I went, oh my God, that's exactly the way I think. And they talked about alcohol being the solution for their problems. And because I really didn't see alcohol to be the problem. I identify with the fact that alcohol is the solution for the problems that I've got, and so, yeah, I felt like I was at home. I walked into a meeting and there was people who were talking a language that I had never heard before, and I got it. It was the first time I think people talk about, you know, that lesson at school where they handed out the guidelines to how to fit in life.
Yeah.
And I happened to be away that day. I didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And as I was sitting there was people who talked about how they drank in a particular way, and which I really did sort of go, yeah, that's the way I drank. The consequences of my drinking were different to theirs, but they definitely, once they start, they can't stop. But they had all these living problems as well, and they were getting over them. And that's really what I was looking for. I was looking for a way to live life and be happy, because I was just miserable.
Yeah. So what was your family doing at this point? How were they coping with you?
Well, that was just keeping away. I think, you know, I was married 17 years and at that stage, and my daughters were 11 and 8. And I think they were just shocked. There was no consistency in my house. They had no idea what sort of father or husband was going to show up day in, day out. I think they were elated that I'd made a decision to stop drinking. And in early days, at the time when I went to rehab, I think that was inconvenient, but they were happy.
It was better than the other option,
which was that I was still drinking. And I think it happened right on my daughter's birthday, and she wasn't happy about that. My wife was particularly sick that day, and someone else had to take me to the rehab. And I think but when I stopped drinking, you know, I expected that I would stop drinking and everything would get rosy and the life would get better, and that my wife would love me, you know, the way I needed to be loved, and that my kids would appreciate me much more, and that, you know, that they would see what a great bloke I am, and really I was just going through a rough trot, and really the problem was the alcohol, and that wasn't what happened. What happened was they went, God, you're so angry.
Yeah.
You're so frustrated. Can't you sit still? You know, why are you going to all these meetings? Why aren't you coming home? Why aren't you changing? It was really, you know, now I was, I think that they were a bit shocked. They were happy for the fact that I stopped drinking, and now they just wanted to see what I was going to do next.
Yeah, so things got worse instead of better.
Oh, you bet. My experience is that at 3 months without having a drink and doing nothing else except going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I want to jump off a bridge. With a book in my hand, with a big book in my hand of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know what happens when I drink. When I drink, it gets out of control and I can't stop. But my other alternative is I know what it's like to be sober, and that's really uncomfortable. And so then I've got to make a decision between not drinking and drinking, which one's more painful.
Yep.
And suicide looks like an attractive alternative. And that's the best thinking I can come up with, is that I can't drink, so I'll die.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And that puts, you know, how selfish is that?
Yep. Okay, at this point, we might cut to another song, and this one is another Elton John, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. So enjoy.
My
Ah, and that was a song called Goodbye Yellow Brick Road by Elton John. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR on digital radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. We're talking with Chrissy and Michael about alcoholism and recovering with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. Chrissy, so you got into AA.
Yep.
And what did your family think about you seeking help?
It's
your husband.
Yeah, my husband was thrilled. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be in a position where it was still, you know, sort of a team effort. And I understand that's not everyone's story by the time they get to AA. But I am grateful that at that point in time, I mean, he was just absolutely thrilled. My mum's, funnily enough, had, you know, she was, forever, had called me an alcoholic from very early days, saying you're just like your father and yada yada. And then the moment I turned around and said, actually, I think I am an alcoholic and I'm going into a rehab, she's like, well, don't you think that's a bit extreme? And, you know, so it's funny how people can, particularly, I guess, for a mum, I can understand her, you know, sort of ignorance. She's not to know. She wasn't to know, like, my condition. She's certainly very, very different today. But, she found that a bit offensive and, you know, but that wasn't the point. For my immediate family, my husband and my kids, it was an absolute godsend and a blessing. You know, it just, I was introduced to AA via the rehab. I didn't know that AA existed before the rehab, or I thought, you know, it was in the US. So when the doctors said, you know, you're going to your first meeting, again, I mean, I couldn't get my head around it. And it was at Malvern, the meeting on a Tuesday night, and I went in there and, you know, literally knew immediately that I was in the right place. Really did. Yeah. I was gobsmacked. Like, I just thought, oh my goodness, not only am I a true alcoholic, but there is a solution, you know? And so all of these different emotions of sort of relief and, you know, hope, and but then a bit of guilt and remorse, and I was overwhelmed with emotion, and I had numbed emotion of any description for a long time. So it was full on, and I needed every second of that 28 days away from life's responsibilities, you know, just to cope with what had happened and you know, what my future was to hold. But at least, you know, I had some hope and I had something to look forward to, and so did my family. So, I was told to get to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I did that. And, you know, look, I've found it hasn't, you know, been an easy road. Obviously, you know, I've got to put a lot of action in, and I'm pretty good at in meetings, like talking the talk. Now, if you sort of hang around long enough, you can really just talk the talk. But there's been times when things haven't sort of been traveling that well, but thankfully I've got, you know, a lot of friends and a sponsor in AA now who really do keep me on track, and I it sounds corny, but I owe my life to AA. I really do. And for that reason, I am not just happy to give back, but it really fills me up to give back and to carry the message and to help others. It, you know, I wake up every morning with that enthusiasm and think, great, you know, and at night it means I can help other girls who have been in my position. And, you know, we just have chats, and there's nothing better than watching somebody else come out the other side, you know?
Yeah, it's fantastic, so, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you must be finding too that there's a lot more women in AA, particularly young women in AA today, than there was 10 years ago from...
I've heard, you know, I sort of personally wasn't here 10 years ago, but definitely. I mean, you know, from when AA certainly first started, there were very few women. But now, there's also not so much, like, you get the high bottom drunks, in that, you know, we don't have to necessarily have lost everything to walk into AA. So you do get people that have still got jobs and, husbands or wives or whatever, relationships, kids, all the rest of it. Some people have lost a lot, you know, there's different stories everywhere, but not everyone. I think when AA first started, they were really, really, frankly, low bottom drunks, you know, and that kind of, that baseline has definitely risen. So you get people who are still functioning in society, but internally, have ceased to function, and that was me. So,
I think a lot more younger people are coming in too.
Yeah, definitely.
Earlier in their drinking.
They get to stop before a whole lot of yets, you know, take place, and that's really exciting, actually. Like seeing how many, you know, people in their 20s and even late teens have seen, and certainly their 30s. Like, yeah, younger people are coming in and getting sober and living sober and just being really, really, like, living just full, happy, awesome lives. And not having to leave it until the death knock, basically. And that's really good. And, you know, there's groups around that are just for sort of younger people, and, you know, and that's cool. And I love the social life of AA now. We've got a trivia night that's coming up, and you know, can't wait. Like, it's just a whole lot of fun, and the focus is no longer alcohol, and the focus is on people. And I never thought I'd enjoy human beings, and yeah, funnily enough, I do. Like, it's they're great.
Thank you. Yeah, cool. So Michael said before that, you know, people annoyed him, and I think that's, people get in the way of drinking. And I think that's one of the primary annoyances. So, Michael, what happened when you got into AA? How did it change your view of life?
I discovered once I'd stopped drinking that I was really just a 13-year-old boy in the body of a 41-year-old man, and I had no life living skills. You know, I had some street smarts that had got me through and managed to survive to being 41, but I didn't have any skills to go forward, and so I'd asked for help. So, and that was unusual for me to ask for help. I really believed that your job worth doing you did yourself, and no one else could be trusted. Yep. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found that when I asked for help, people were happy to give it, and that just astounded me. That people were so selfless, and the first person I asked for help, whenever I would ask him a question, he would say to me, "What would a grown-up do?" And I go, "I don't know."
Surprisingly, you'd never thought of that.
I'd never thought of that was the case. And so what I found was, you know, I got told that it was a spiritual program. The Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program, and I had no idea what that looked like. And so I thought that meant sitting with my legs crossed and my arms out and going, "Om." And what someone suggested to me was, "Why don't you try being honest? That's an honest action." I go, "That's a spiritual action." I go, "Really? I'd never tried that." In any time in my life that honesty was okay, that it would be enough. And why not you just try and do what you say you're going to do? Like, why don't you tell your kids where you're going to be and actually show up? And there was some really basic stuff.
Hard stuff.
It is, but it had been. It'd always been hard. I'd never been able to do it.
Yeah.
I was going to be this. I was going to do that. And so I just started doing. And that was, so I discovered that Alcoholics Anonymous offers a program of recovery which is all about actions that I take, because no one can judge me on my thinking. They can't see inside my head. And so I might have the best intentions in the world, but I was never able to live up to those intentions. And I drank on that, and that inability to live up to my intentions. And so I started to put in some things that, you know, Chrissy talked about, not low self-esteem. So I had to do some esteemable acts to build my self-esteem. And Alcoholics Anonymous showed me how to do that, and someone else helped me to do that. Because if that was just the solution, I would have thought of that years ago, if I had the ability just to do that. So I had to have somebody else show me. And being teachable certainly isn't my special skill.
Yeah.
And so I had to be in a place where I was willing to go whatever it takes. And that's been my experience, is that they wouldn't call it a journey of recovery if I just followed a path. I do what I'm told. Yeah. I know what happens. I get to see the results of it because I watch other people. AA is just a big show and tell operation. Someone stands up at the front of a meeting and they say, "It used to be like this, and this is what happened, and this is what it's like now." And I go, "Yeah," and I'm sitting there nodding through the meeting, going, you bet, I'm just like that.
Yeah.
And so it's a big show and tell, and I get to see the results. And so I know the results are on offer, but I still want to take my own path. Just let me add a little bit of authorship to it and do it my way a little bit. And whenever that happens, I have an experience, I learn something, and I found that AA is a really safe place to learn those things, because I'm learning life skills. It's been, so I'm a full participant in my own life now. Mm-hmm. I have, my daughters are now 20 and 17, they were in my life enough through their teen years to drive me insane.
Yeah.
How lucky am I to have teenage daughters that drive me insane? Because that certainly wasn't on the cards when I was drinking. and now I'm, you know, I do whatever I can to help them. I help other people in Alcoholics Anonymous when I get an opportunity. I have a full life. I'm in a relationship with another human being, which I never thought possible, that actually cares about me and I care about her. That's
good.
Shocking.
Yeah. So your kids, so you mentioned that they're in Alateen.
Yeah, they're not doing it at the moment, yeah. But yeah, they did. We had a couple of big things happen in our lives, and for my youngest daughter, and I knew that they were suffering from the results of my alcoholism. So the way I think, and my lack of parenting skills, and a few other things, and so I took them to an Alateen meeting, and they identified with the. Recovery program of the fact that they're affected by someone else is drinking, and they got, you know, we talked about it earlier, but before the today, but that about, you know, they when they go there, I am the alcoholic in their life, the drinker in their life, and they don't talk about my drinking. They talk about what I was like when in my first year of not drinking, right. What a nutcase, yeah. I was, and but they're getting a great, they learn a lot of self skills, their life skills for themselves about asking for help. Trusting others, yeah. And that's been a really good outcome for them.
Yeah, yeah. I think growing up in an alcoholic situation, you learn a lot of survival skills, and they've got to be converted into life skills. The survival skills don't go well in social situations.
Mm.
Yeah. They're not compatible, basically. So yeah, so having kids who understand that their parent is sick and is just not a willful drinker is really important, because you get a bit of empathy. And you think, yeah, man, imagine if that was me. Imagine if I couldn't stop drinking. And I think that was the thing that happened to me when I went to my first AA meeting, and I sat there not knowing anything about alcoholism and heard these AAs talk about what it's like to be an alcoholic and to be able to look out through the alcoholic eyes and see the damage you're causing and not being able to do anything to stop it. And I got a lot of empathy for my dad at that point, just seeing that that's happening and the fact that maybe he wasn't willfully trying to wreck our lives, which is really what we thought. Yeah. Mm. Well, we're getting close to the end, so we've got a few announcements as well. So I think I'd like to, first of all, thank Chrissy and Michael for coming in today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having us.
It's been sensational.
And also for sharing your AA recovery experience. Unfortunately, Living Free won't be broadcast next week, but the good news is that instead, 3CR is celebrating NAIDOC Week from 3rd to the 7th of July. This year, they're proudly presenting Beyond the Bars, a unique, one-of-a-kind radio project, giving a voice to brothers and sisters on the inside from Victorian prisons and correctional centres. Tune in to hear the deadly solid sounds coming to you directly from behind the bars. Next Thursday, between 12 and 3, the broadcast will come from Port Phillip Prison. If you stay tuned now, we have Black Noise Radio, hosted by Kerry Lee, and featuring black news and views, current affairs, music, sport, culture and the arts, from an Aboriginal woman's perspective. To take us out, I'll just play you a song, and the song is Hang On Babe from Monique Brumby.
The world's without me, 'cause the world still turns. There's always a new dawn. It follows reflections. What we all learn. Hang on, babe. I will be right there. Don't go anywhere without me.
Guatemala, I'm Black Betty, and you can join me for Black Noise Radio each Thursday from 2 to 3pm. Join me each week as I serve you up a deadly fine offering of all things black, as we explore Black Australia and everything fabulous it has on the offer. We'll check out and see what's making black news locally and from right around Australia. And we'll explore all things Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander and the deadly solid culture and people with a look at community news, views, music, culture and the arts. Hope you can join me for Black Noise Radio, featuring black news, views, current affairs, music, culture and the arts from an Aboriginal woman's perspective. That's me, Black Betty. I'll see you Thursdays at 2. Right here on 3CR Radio. Very good afternoon to you, Black Betty. In the chair with you once again. Must be Thursday, eh? Look out. Ah, it's about a couple of minutes past 2 o'clock, 14 degrees outside, a little bit cool and grey and overcast out there today. But don't worry, because we're going to have a pretty deadly program coming your way this hour. Coming up, we're going to be previewing what's happening for NAIDOC Week across Melbourne and Victoria. So stay tuned for that one. Coming up this hour, we'll be checking out all of the things, hopefully as much as we can, for NAIDOC. NAIDOC Week, of course, happens each year. It's happening from this Monday, but things do start to kick off over the weekend as well. A part of that NAIDOC celebration right here in Melbourne, Malthouse Theatre, present Heart is a Wasteland, featuring Aaron Pedersen and Ursula Jovich. And I'll be joined on the program today by John Harvey, and I can't wait to have a yarn with Brother John about how he's written his first play, Heart is a Wasteland, with the Malthouse Theatre. It previews tonight and opening night, Friday night. Of course, tomorrow, right here on 3CR Radio, 8:55 a.m. Black Betty in the chair with you this afternoon. Thanks for your company on this Thursday. Time now for a song. I kind of need to hear this today. I think I need to hear a little bit of this man, Mr. Kutcher Edwards. This is Stand Strong, right here on 3CR Black Noise Radio.
Within visions I see, daring to dream my destiny. So much sorrow, heartache we have. Comfort our children, they shed a tear.